Alfie Cohn has been described in Time magazine as perhaps the country's most outspoken critic of education's fixation on grades and test scores. Cohn writes and lectures about progressive education at schools, universities, and corporations, and his critiques have helped to shape the questions we're asking about education reform today. His latest book is called Feel Bad Education. Cohn says part of the problem is that we don't give kids a say in what they learn.
You can't skip the part about how kids view what they're doing. That's why research, for example, fails to show much of a benefit to homework. In fact, there's no benefit whatsoever until kids are in high school. That's directly related to the fact that most kids hate most homework and had nothing to say about what they're doing. You can't treat people in a workplace or in a classroom as if they're mechanical objects and try to squeeze performance out of them. What predicts to excellence is interest, and thus the best schools are those where their question every day as educators is, how do we help kids to become more enthusiastic about playing with words and numbers and ideas? Sadly, that concept is conspicuously missing from any discussion about school reform, as the concept is talked about today.
It started, though, don't you think, as a means of assuring that every student was going to get the best available education? We saw some students coming out of our school system unable to accomplish much, and so we set about trying to find ways to standardize education to provide the best for all comers.
And what we provide is a standardized education for all comers, which actually drags everyone down. This basic narrative to which we've been exposed, that the U.S. is in trouble compared to other countries, which turns out to be only partly true with an enormous number of qualifications attached, and therefore we have to raise the level, not only distorts the reality of what we found before, but overlooks the poverty of this approach in terms of what we're experiencing today. There is a big difference between excellence and uniformity. And people who are talking about national core standards, where you have to be subjected to the same basic curriculum or style of instruction, the same assessments from one area to another, that one-size-fits-all approach doesn't mean that anyone is going to be getting a better education. Or to put it differently, to say that we want high standards for schooling, which I certainly do, is very different from saying that we should have the same standards for all kids in all communities across the country. And we're being sold a bill of goods right now in terms of very prescriptive, behavioristic standards for what's taught and what's tested. I mean, the people driving this movement are much more likely to be corporate executives and politicians than to be people who really understand how learning happens. And unfortunately, a lot of educators have capitulated to this drive for uniformity, either because they're afraid to speak out or because they haven't been invited to reflect on the difference between excellence on the one hand and uniformity or competitiveness on the other.
Isn't it funny in a way that we do this? Because I think if you were to ask each of us about our children or our grandchildren, we would say, oh, but mine is special. And his approach or her approach to education shouldn't have to be the same as everybody else's because I know he has these talents or those talents.
Right, exactly. And you can't have a one-size-fits-all set of standards and tests and approach to education that overlooks what makes each child unique. The best teachers don't teach the same lesson in third grade that they taught in third grade last year, or that the third grade teacher down the hall is doing. It would be odd to do that. It would be malpractice, because the best curriculum is devised for and with this particular group of students, based on their questions about themselves and the world, based on their capacities, their limits, based on what turns them on and is likely to help them become increasingly sophisticated. So the more we routinize the process and say it's got to be the same, we expect all of these kids to have acquired this bunch of facts by a certain time, the more we ruin education for all the kids involved, even if some parents can see the problem only when it affects their own children.
What about grading? I know that you have no great enthusiasm for it, but it is a part of our education system and has been for about as long as anybody can remember. How do you propose that we measure learning, or indeed can we measure learning if we're not grading?
The process of assessment is basically a two-step dance. First, you have to acquire information about how well each child is learning, who needs help and with what. And then second, you have to feed back what you've learned as a teacher, perhaps with an evaluation attached, to the student and his or her parents. So there's two steps to it. You have to acquire information about the learning, and then you have to share what you know. What's really remarkable, and that few of us have been asked to think about, is that you never need tests for step one, and you never need grades for step two. So, for example, the best teachers rarely give tests of their own devising and never pay attention to standardized test scores because they know that tests tend to measure what matters least. When kids are actively involved in meaningful projects, sometimes on their own, sometimes with other students, at the same time that they're learning, the teacher is learning about who needs help and how much kids are getting and what she needs to do to assist. The test is mostly just about how many forgettable facts the kids have shoved into their short-term memory. At the same time, once the teacher knows what's going on, the teacher would never want to reduce a child's proficiency to a summary letter or number. That has the effect mostly of trying to manipulate kids with bribes or threats into doing more of what they understandably, in many classrooms, have little interest in doing. And so the alternative to grades are either to offer a narrative report, a written summary, not using a letter like A or B or a number, to explain what's going on with the kid, or better yet, a conversation with the student and or the student's parents in order to talk about what's been going on and what our hopes are in the future.
I like the hopefulness of that, but I'm going to stick with grading for a second because I suspect that there are some other opinions you may have about it that we ought to hear. It seems to me there are two sides of the grading thing, and one of the advantages of grades is so that the outsiders who have no interest in this except that they're funding it want some measure of success. And the other is I suspect that grades may be for the ease of bad teachers.
Well, the first thing that really helps mediocre teachers is standardized testing, especially when the state has a list of standards where everyone in fourth grade in English will acquire the following competencies. The teacher doesn't have to think and be a professional educator. The teacher just has to be a test prep technician. Standardized testing is a way of making really inadequate teaching look effective because you can show higher scores when all you've done is make kids better test takers. And conversely, some of the best teaching doesn't get reflected in standardized test scores because the tests are lousy measures of anything intellectual that counts. Grades are a way not only of reflecting what the teacher thinks the kid has done, but of trying to control the classroom by saying, if you don't study this, if you don't come here on time, if you don't memorize more facts on command, your grade will drop. So it's a way of doing things to students to make them comply rather than working with students to help them learn. That's why the best teachers minimize grades if they have to give them at all.
Well, that does flip you to the other side of the equation, which is the student. And I suppose that grades, we've all been patterned to believe in grades, but there are other effects to grades for the students, aren't there? You start saying, well, it doesn't really matter how that works as long as I know what the answer is.
The research on grading has found three robust effects when you compare students who are told this is for a grade with students who are not graded, but they're given the identical stuff to learn. The students who are trying to get a good grade, A, tend to become less interested in whatever it is they're doing. Every study on that topic has found that result. Students are less excited about reading, about math, about this particular topic, if they're trying to do it for a grade. B, students trying to get a good grade will pick the easiest possible task if they're given a choice when they're doing it for a grade. Not because they're lazy, but because they're rational. Duh, they figure, the simpler the thing I'm doing, the better the chance I can give you what you seem to want, which is not intellectual risk-taking. It's the opposite of risk-taking. It's just to get an A. And C, kids who are trying to get a good grade tend to forget what they learned faster and think in a more superficial fashion. So the more interested we are in kids who love learning, prefer challenge, and want to think deeply, the less we have to be grading them, and the more we have to be thinking about other ways to assess the classroom.
Well, let's talk about what we can do that's right then, starting with what I assume is your basic premise, that we have to nurture a love of learning. How do we do that?
You don't have to make kids love learning. You have to start by being committed to not killing the curiosity about the world that all students start out with. And there's at least 10 studies have found that children's intrinsic motivation, their curiosity, their disposition to figure stuff out, make sense of the world, starts out very high when they're young, and then, subject to worksheets, homework, quizzes, lectures, grades, standardized tests, behavior management programs, that desire to figure stuff out about the world begins quite reliably to tail off. And that's not an inevitable progression, because it doesn't happen as much in schools that are less traditional and less teacher-centered. What we have to do, and what great teachers that I see all over the country and beyond doing when I visit, is starting with projects and problems and questions as the organizing principles of teaching, rather than facts and skills and separate disciplines. That's not to say that facts and skills don't count. It's to say that they exist in a context and for a purpose. And the other characteristics that tend to describe amazing classrooms where kids are disappointed when the final bell rings are, first, that it feels like a caring community of learners where we're in this together. We're never set against each other in a contest, and we're only rarely isolated from each other on separate desks. And second, the kids play an active role, and as well as an interactive role, in helping to design what it is they're learning and all the other features of the classroom, like how the furniture is arranged and what goes on the wall and what we're going to read next and where we're going to take our field trip. Because people of all ages tend to excel when they enjoy what they're doing, and they tend to enjoy what they're doing more when they have some voice.
Alfie Cohn is an expert on parenting and education. His latest book is called Feel Bad Education,